This edition of The Briefing was first broadcast on the 3rd of March, 2015, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme...
Сейчас у меня статус свидетеля.
Now I'm a witness. I gave all the possible evidence, and I don't understand why I'm still in Russia.
Boris Nemtsov's girlfriend managed to flee Russia this morning for her mother's home in Ukraine, but will intimidation from the Kremlin follow her? Also on the programme...
Attenzione perché...
Be careful of these villains that are governing us. They are controlled by Brussels, and in the name of saving money, they are stealing our future. They are stealing our democracy.
Ci stanno rubando la democrazia.
After an angry black-shirted crowd waving signs depicting Mussolini greeted Italy's Lega Nord leader Matteo Salvini at a rally in Rome at the weekend, how is the rise of the right affecting the political climate in the country? And later in the show, we'll check in with Monocle's transport editor Tristan McAllister, who's no doubt busy choosing his next set of wheels at the Geneva Motor Show. All that and more besides coming up right here on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. It's 12 noon here in London, 7 a.m. in New York City. This is The Briefing, and there's a busy show in prospect. Let's start, though, by looking through what's making headlines on the North American newspapers today. Here with the front pages to hand is Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, welcome. Where should we start?
Tom, hello. Another day, another Hillary Clinton story. This time on the front of the New York Times, Clinton used personal email at State Department. This is fascinating. Hillary Clinton didn't have a government email address during her entire four-year tenure at the State Department. So she used her personal email address. And so that means that her advisors have now had to review tens of thousands of pages of her personal emails and decide which ones need to be turned over to the State Department for their record keeping. As I say, you know, at the beginning, you know, another Hillary Clinton story. It seems as if every day there really is one about, you know, either her time in office or about the Clinton Foundation. And these are going to keep on going, particularly given that there's no proper race for Democratic nominations. So there's no policy differences. So it's all going to be personal stuff like this. So interesting.
Extraordinary story. I mean, you'd think her correspondence would be in the public domain. Extraordinary, anyway.
Anyway, so there we are. LA Times, obviously going big on the death of a homeless man killed by a police officer a couple of days ago. On Skid Row, sweeping change adds to distrust. Another story, video of LAPD killing stirs outrage. That is really the main story, understandably, on the front of the Los Angeles Times. I don't think this incident is a surprise, said a community activist. And there's a picture of a makeshift memorial there to the man who was known to his friends as Africa. One more story. Washington Post, leaving her mark on Congress. Senator Barbara A. Mikulski, the Maryland Democrat. She was the longest serving woman in congressional history. And it says she will depart Capitol Hill the way she arrived, with a sharp tongue, an unabashed liberalism, and a mission to make the Senate a place where women belong.
Oh, good luck to her, Steve.
There we are. That's the papers, Tom.
Thank you very much. That's Monocle Steve Bloomfield with the headlines on the North American front pages this day. We are going to talk next about the headlines in the world of business. Joining me next on the programme is Reuters editor-at-large Axel Threlfall. Axel, welcome to The Briefing. Great to speak with you as ever. Let's start off by looking to Germany and a big leap in retail sales. What does this tell us about the bigger picture?
Well, I mean, it really does look very good. Consumer morale in Germany, highest level in more than 13 years. Record employment there, higher pay. They've had some great wage deals done recently by the biggest trade union, IG Metall, securing an inflation busting 3.4% hike recently. So all looks good on that front. We've got cheap oil, healthy income gains, as I just mentioned, low rates. And trading risks all around, making it a very strong start to the year for the German retailers. As you said, they jumped, hitting the highest level in 7 years. So a lot of people are going to be revising their growth forecast for Germany, especially Q1. Most people are looking at around 0.3-0.4% quarter on quarter in Q1. That is likely to go up.
And I wonder, I mean, is this politically good news then, Axel, for, you know, Angela Merkel and others back at home in the administration there? Or do people still, you know, more preoccupied politically with other issues, perhaps?
No, I mean, this is great news for Angela Merkel on the domestic front. But of course, one thing this does do is shine a spotlight on how well Germany seems to be coping as others around, and I look particularly at France and, of course, the Greece story, suffer. And this, again, puts a lot more pressure on Merkel not to do soft deals with other players in the Eurozone. So you know, while on the domestic front, things look good, given the retail sales, the wage hikes, et cetera, she does need to be careful.
Well, that leads us rather elegantly onto Greece, Axel, and you know, an increasing risk of the so-called Grexit, an odious portmanteau expression for a potential Greek exit from the Eurozone, but the risk is rising.
Yeah, it is rising. I mean, look, this is one of these consultancy firm indexes. We've seen now, I think they spoke to about 1,000 institutional investors and other individuals, and it looks like people seeing now 37% of them saying they expect Athens to leave the currency block over the next 12 months. Just to put that into context, that's up from about 6% in July last year, but down from almost 71% of the height of the debt crisis. But look, it is rising, this fear of a Grexit. Clearly, the new aid program for the country and the extension to that doesn't seem to be convincing the market. So, yeah, right now, Grexit looks on the cards. And indeed, just to put this into a bigger picture, the chance of any country leaving the bloc right now, according to these respondents, is about 38%.
Interesting numbers. And other interesting numbers from Glencore, Axel. Tell us what we've learned from those.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're always keen to look what Ivan Glasenberg does at Glencore. This is an interesting company, pretty much in line with expectations, a 2% drop in 2014 core profit. Now, interestingly, they took an impairment charge, $1.1 billion, given the lower commodity price environment. So no great surprises there. So that's the industrial stuff, the industrial division taking a hit in profit. Marketing division was up about 15%, so that offset that to a large extent. But about half of this $1 billion impairment stemming from a pause, if you like, in some of the iron ore projects around the world as prices plunge. And we've seen a number of commodities really take a hit, and Glencore, as a result, taking a hit from that. But as I said, marketing looked pretty good, so overall not too bad.
The insights there of Axel Threlfall, full editor-at-large for Reuters. Axel, thanks as ever for joining us here on The Briefing. To Russia next. Boris Nemtsov's girlfriend, Anna Juritska, fled to her mother's home in Ukraine earlier today after being released by Russian authorities. The 23-year-old model was with the Russian opposition leader when he was shot 4 times late on Friday, dying at the scene close to the Kremlin. Nemtsov joins a long list of Putin critics who've met a grisly demise, which has left Russia virtually without an opposition. So, is intimidation from the Kremlin likely to follow Anna Juritska as she moves back to Ukraine? Well, joining us to discuss this and other facets of the case is Mary Dievsky, a columnist for the Independent newspaper here in London. Mary, let me just ask you, I mean, do you think that Anna Juritska was already painted by some sources close to the Kremlin as a, you know, a potential aggressor in this case? They were pointing out her Ukrainian heritage. Is she going to remain the subject, do you think, of intimidation?
I would think she's probably made a very sensible move to return to Ukraine. It looks to me as though the Kremlin is looking for any possible scapegoats it can find here. And it's very sort of disturbing development. I mean, Nemtsov, and he was known to have had a rather colourful private life over the last decade, and the fact that, you know, he was gunned down with when he was in the company of, you know, his much younger girlfriend, that's, you know, it's one aspect of the case. The other aspect is that because she was Ukrainian, some people will see in that part of an explanation for the fact that he seemed so very pro-Ukrainian in his views at a time when Russian mainstream opinion was moving so swiftly in the very Russian, Russo-centric direction. And I think that's one of the reasons why he alienated not just the authorities, but maybe people who were of a nationalist disposition, who felt that Nemtsov had moved much more towards being, well, the climate is such that if you appeared even slightly to be in favor of Ukraine, then you were seen as potentially a traitor. And it appears that there were people prepared to act on that.
Mary, let me ask you, a lot of people obviously have said from the outset of the investigation, at least, that it's deeply flawed because, you know, Vladimir Putin has suggested he'll sort of personally oversee it, and it will be with his sort of close quarters security services will supervise the investigation. People from without say, look, that's inherently flawed, and there's no hope of any sort of, objective review of the case. Do you share that scepticism?
Well, I think the problem for Putin is that he's damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't, because his initial response to the killing of Anna Politkovskaya nearly 8 years ago now was he sounded really quite cold and unsympathetic, and the authorities seemed to be quite obstructive in pursuing her killers, though eventually some people were brought to trial. I think that Putin understood the damage that would be done to Russia and to him personally by the what he described quite rightly, I think, as probably a contract killing in the shadow of the Kremlin. So to take charge of it and to put, as it were, the capacity of the state, including the intelligence services, presumably, behind this investigation, that may be the only way of actually producing a plausible result. The problem is that, you know, as you will know and everybody will know, for Putin to be to place himself at the head of it makes it look as though it's bound to be a whitewash. So, as I say, you know, on the one hand, he needs to have an investigation. He needs to have it with all the forces at his disposal. On the other hand, to head it looks as though it's not going to reach a conclusion. I mean, personally, I wouldn't be so sceptical of that, because I think it's extremely damaging for Putin, and that he should be doing everything in his power to find out what happened and to bring the assassin or assassins to justice. But he's got, at some point, he's got to relinquish that investigation and detach himself from it to make sure that justice looks like justice. And of course, the scepticism is such that that won't be able to happen.
Mary, just a final thought. I mentioned in the introduction this idea of, you know, we're leaving a scene with very increasingly few players, you know, in terms of active opposition, because they're either jailed on trumped up charges, or they're threatened, or they leave the country. Is there a very real risk here that even those hardy sort of, you know, remaining opponents of Kremlin and outspoken critics of Putin, you know, will be cowed when they continue to see instances like this?
Well, I wouldn't completely agree with you, because I think there are two completely different things at play here. One of them is that I think that the shock associated with the killing of Nemtsov could actually galvanize the opposition. I mean, we saw the procession on Sunday that probably attracted far more people than the originally planned opposition march. And so I think there will be, that they were carrying banners which said, you know, we are not afraid. And I think there is there is a sense in which the opposition will be galvanized. The other thing I would say is that I think the opposition to Putin and to, as it were, conservative forces in Russia is changing. It's becoming more modern and more up-to-date. The interesting thing about Nemtsov is that although he was only in his mid-50s, he was actually a veteran of the opposition movement from way back in the late 80s. And it's that generation which, in a sense, is bowing out either by force or voluntarily, and the people taking over are people like Navalny, who uses the internet. You know, he's currently 15 days in prison for a violation of his suspended sentence order. But he has an influence which is using social media, using the internet, which doesn't need the official television, official newspapers. And there are other people. There are other people like him. There is a new generation, which is at home in the world beyond Russia, and in the virtual world of the internet. And I think when we're looking at the Russian opposition now, we're looking at a very transitional opposition between the opposition of the 80s and 90s, and looking ahead to something which may be quite different.
And there we must leave it. Mary Dzhevsky of the Independent newspaper here in London, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the briefing on Monocle 24. Twelve sixteen here in London, 7:16 in Washington, D.C., where there's a great deal of anticipation ahead of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's speech to Congress, in which he's expected to restate criticisms of the U.S. for ongoing negotiations with Iran over its nuclear development. Coming just 2 weeks ahead of Israeli elections, many are speculating on what Netanyahu's motivation for all of this criticism might be. His insistence in the build-up that relations between the U.S. and Israel are as strong as ever has also raised some eyebrows. On today's edition of The Globalist, Yossi Meckelberg from Chatham House told Emma Nelson that Netanyahu's motives likely do stem from domestic politics.
We can take the more cynical view that he's 2 weeks before elections. His standing in the public opinion polls is not great. His achievements in times in office are far from being impressive. Playing the statesman in America 2 weeks before election probably won't do him much harm.
Yossi Meckelberg talking on Monocle 24 a little earlier. I'm joined now in the studio here at Midori House by Daniela Pellet from the Institute for War and Peace reporting. Daniela, is it just sort of too easy to dismiss this as political posturing and sort of grandstanding ahead of his domestic agenda? Or would you agree that is at least, you know, part of what's motivating him?
Well, Netanyahu, I think, sees himself as the Messiah who's tasked with saving Israel and the Jewish people. And he has had this kind of obsession with Iran as a major existential threat to the existence of Israel for the last, you know, 15, 20 years. I mean, he's consistently kept to that. But I think even if we were looking at this rather forgivingly, it's clear that he's doing this for political gain at home. And the margins could be quite small in this coming election. And Likud strategists are saying that this speech could possibly get him two extra seats in the Israeli Knesset, which could be enough to put him in a position to form the next government.
So one might say in response to that, then it's rather unsurprising that he adopts this more aggressive rhetoric. Just in terms of what he's had to say, though, about the relationship with the US more broadly, he suggests that it's as strong as ever. But this Iran issue is certainly adding to pressure on both sides, isn't it, in terms of how close and how effectively they can work together?
It's not as strong as ever by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, this is a crisis. I mean, Netanyahu has not been known for his rapport with the current or previous American administrations he's had to work through. But, you know, the strategic relationship transcends personal ties. It should transcend politics as well. But all of this chips away at trust. The Americans are saying that they're wary of sharing sensitive information with the Israelis because for fear that they'll leak it to their, you know, brief for their own interests. And Netanyahu really has, I mean, this is a humiliation. You know, Obama was describing his speech now rather than a war. He was talking about it as commentary. Netanyahu's commentary, he said yesterday, which is a rather disdainful way of talking about a key ally. I mean, yesterday, Netanyahu, addressing AIPAC, took a rather more conciliatory tone. But I mean, he could do that. It's like the birthday boy addressing a birthday party. I mean, there could be no warmer, more loving, cuddly atmosphere for an Israeli prime minister to speak out than AIPAC. This today's speech, well, I mean, he's a master orator, but he's going to have to tread a very, very, very careful line to, you know, even give the impression of not being partisan.
So what happens next then in this relationship? Because obviously, you know, the US sights are also set on elections in 2016. There'll be, you know, new faces in the White House and a lot of new faces, one imagines, on Capitol Hill more broadly. Let's say that Netanyahu is successful, domestically at least, and as you said, this speech today could play a role in that. What does he need to do in terms of rebuilding the relationship or restoring some of that trust that you say has kind of gone missing?
Well, if a Republican, if the next president of the United States is a Republican, then he doesn't have to do very much. I think his ties are pretty strong. I mean, he's for all the rhetoric that it's not the Israel issue shouldn't be bipartisan, he's made it partisan. If, however, there is a Democrat in the White House, I think things will be rather more dicey. I mean, above and beyond all this, Israel and America have enormous mutual interests in security, intelligence, trade, and so on, and so forth. But if on an issue like Iran, where there might be some differences, but fundamentally, America and Israel do not want to see a nuclear Iran. They've just got some differences in the way they're going about it. If this issue, where there should be a consensus, highlights such immense differences, I think that's going to be troubling for whoever is going to be in the White House, certainly if Netanyahu is sitting in Jerusalem at that time.
And just finally, Daniela, in terms of Iran then, and we look to sort of best practice in terms of trying to safeguard this idea, as you said, preventing the development of them as a nuclear nation. The Americans seem to be sort of arriving at an approach that they want to take. Again, we can only speculate whether that will endure beyond 2016. What's the sense from Israel? Is it just that there should be no discussions even with Iran, just the talks are even problematic? Or are people sort of reconciled to the idea that there needs to be some form of engagement to move forwards positively?
I think there is a consensus, an enormous, enormous consensus that the Iranian nuclear program forms an existential threat to the future of Israel. The right and the left will agree on that. But many very senior Israeli intelligence security officials disagree outspokenly with Netanyahu's way of handling it and say that this isn't an Israel issue, this is a world issue, and Israel needs to work with the world to find a consensus. So any future administration, if Netanyahu doesn't succeed in the elections, is not going to take a softer line on Iran, but I think they'll take a more conciliatory line with working with the international community. I mean, they'll call for sanctions, they'll call for strong measures. But the idea that Israel is keeping this threat that it will take unilateral military action against Iran, I think that's seen as strong-arming the international community, not very diplomatic.
No, indeed. Daniela Pellet from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
It is 12:23 here in London. Matteo Severini, the leader of Italy's right-wing Lega Nord party, addressed a crowd of thousands in Rome at the weekend. On his agenda was the sort of rabble-rousing rhetoric that's lifted the Lega Nord into mainstream political consciousness, condemning government policy on immigration and accusing Prime Minister Matteo Renzi of pandering to the whims of the EU rather than serving the needs of the Italian people. So what does all this mean for the political climate in Italy? Well, joining us from Milan is Monocle's correspondent in the city, Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, is there a general shift towards the populist sort of policy, populist rhetoric in Italy, as we're seeing in a lot of other countries in Europe at the moment?
Well, I think with Matteo Salvini, he's looking coming from the right now, because we've seen in Greece and also in Spain from the left this thing against austerity, against Brussels and the EU. He's coming at it from a party that's born out of a regional separatist movement that used to always attack Rome for wasting taxpayers' money. Now he's redirecting that towards Europe and copying from the playbook of Marine Le Pen in France.
Well, let me just ask you a bit more about that. It's interesting you talk about Marine Le Pen's sort of general strategy. They've campaigned together, of course. Does Salvini ape that? Does he play this voice for the disenfranchised card, which many of these rightists in Europe seem to enjoy playing?
Yeah, he's working on the that sort of playbook again with the anti-immigration, because Italy has suffered because it bears the brunt of the arrivals coming from North Africa across the sea, and we've had record numbers, so well over 100,000, almost peaking almost up to 200,000, and so that is a burden on the system, and with high unemployment in Italy, people are worried, and so he plays on that. And you've seen, I mean, just recently in the papers, there was a picture of him at a trade fair caressing a cow, and then Marine Le Pen the same day was at a trade fair in France. So they're going after the sort of the local person in who's worried about shrinking wealth in Italy. And he so far seems to be doing well, because on the center right, Silvio Berlusconi has sort of his party, Forza Italia, is crumbling right now.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you a little about that, Ivan. How much of this is to do with the problems that Forza Italia are having rather than anything that the Lega Nord is doing? Are they merely exploiting a political opportunity that's opened up?
Yeah, there appears to be a vacuum, because Silvio Berlusconi is very weak now, and Forza Italia, there have been reports about internal divisions. In the past, Forza Italia and the Northern League, the Lega Nord, were together in coalition. But right now, after this rally in Rome, Berlusconi made some comments about it. He didn't like this very extremist tone that was coming out from Salvini. So it's unsure right now whether or not they would, in these upcoming regional elections, which we have in Italy in the spring, whether they might come back together. There's a debate within both sides, within the Lega Nord, saying, should we join up with Forza Italia to have a higher vote share or not. So right now they're sort of trying to calculate what's the better strategy. We haven't seen anybody make a move yet.
Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's man in Milan, thanks very much for joining us here on The Briefing. Ticking towards the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24. Before the end of today's programme, we're off to Geneva, where the city's celebrated motor show is taking place. Of course, Monocle's transport correspondent Tristan McAllister is there, and he joins us now on the line. Tristan, a Geneva Motor Show is traditionally the place where the big automakers like to reveal lots of exciting new cars and the visions of their bold new thinking. Is innovation on the menu as ever again this year?
As always, yes, Tom, the innovation is on the menu. Although, I pointed out earlier with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Delay, on the station that it seems that it's not stifled, but we have sort of walked back a tad in terms of what we can expect. You know, for a long time, hybrids and sort of fuel efficiency were the name of the game, but this year, SUVs and crossovers are really front and center, especially because the big markets right now, the ones really responding to the automakers are China and North America, and of course those consumers want big, nice cars, and petrol prices are down, so that's really the trend, those cars, not really what we'd seen in the past few years.
Well, I was going to ask you a bit more about that, Tristan, actually, because I always like to get your sense of the general mood around these big trade conferences, these big transport shows. And I guess with oil prices being low, as you mentioned, that's fueling demand, if you'll forgive the pun, in the US at least, for bigger cars. Is the general mood very upbeat, more upbeat perhaps than it's been for a couple of years?
I think it's cautious optimism. Last year, that was sort of a theme. I kept asking, how do you feel about Europe? Well, Europe had a decent year last year, not nearly as good as it had been before the debt crisis and all of that coming to fruition. But you know, there was some optimism there. I think the issue here now is China. Russia, where of course a massive devaluation of the currency. You've seen a lot of brands pull out, frankly, of Russia, and now where a lot of growth was, not so much anymore. And I think that's working against them. But I think sustained comebacks in places like the U.S. and then also the growth in China are really fueling things.
We'll have to keep a close eye on those. There we must leave it. Tristan McAllister in Geneva. That's all we have time for on today's briefing. It was produced by Ben Ryland and researched by Gaia Lutz and Kate Bullivant. Bill Lutie was our studio manager. Keep it tuned with Steve Bloomfield up next.